Welcome to the Big World Made Small podcast for the adventure traveler. I'm thrilled you're here. My name is Jason Elkins, and in addition to being your host, I'm also a former U.S. Army paratrooper, third-generation commercial hot air balloon pilot, paramotor pilot, ex-Montana fly fishing guide, advanced open water scuba diver, and a full-time nomad that's visited more than 30 countries on six continents. As a seasoned adventure travel expert with a passion for creating and sharing meaningful experiences, I'm on a quest to impact the lives of adventure travelers, tour operators they rely on, and the communities that host them. Every week, I bring you exclusive interviews with fascinating adventure tourism experts who have agreed to share their personal stories, favorite destinations, and some invaluable travel insights they've picked up along the way. We'll enjoy a casual conversation, create some connections, and likely share some laughs. It's my hope that by the end of each episode, this big world will feel just a bit smaller. Let's get started, shall we? Welcome, everybody, to another episode of the Big World Made Small podcast for the adventure traveler. Today, I've got a friend from way back, a blast from the past. I am visiting with Pablo Negri Edwards. And Pablo is, what's the official title? Associate Director of Palatine by Viejas Temisco. Is that pretty close, Pablo?
Well, viejas, no. Viejas would be old lady. So I was saying
viajes.
Yeah, you have to, instead of the H, the soft H, you're going to go with the G. But it's pretty cool. Yeah.
All right. Good Spanish. Well, thank you. Yeah, we started the conversation before I pushed the record button. I was speaking a little in Spanish and we were talking about that, but obviously I haven't mastered it yet. So thank you. Thank you for correcting me. So Pablo, I'm just going to share this with the audience that you and I had worked together on some projects back in the past when I was working at Orvis and you were working with Nomads of the Seas down in Chile. I'm sure we'll chat about that here in just a moment. But the big point is it's just super cool to see you again. I'm sitting across, looking at you here on the screen and good to see your face. It's been quite a while. So thank you so much for joining us today.
My pleasure. Yeah, you forgot to say this is not... structured, and you have
this is not a yes, and this is not a scripted, no scripted conversation. It's just we're not going to edit anything, so be careful what you say, Pablo.
Yeah. Okay. You know what? There is a great director, probably the very best regarding documentaries. He is German. I have the pleasure of knowing the guy, meeting him twice, actually in Peru. In Lima and in a friend's house. He's the owner of Incaterra, which is a very well-known and very famous tourism brand in Peru. And the name of this director is Werner Herzog. You probably heard about the guy. Okay,
Fitzcarraldo.
And, of course, you heard about Grizzly Man, which relates to a U.S. He is kind of crazy, but great guy anyway. He did a lot of stuff regarding grizzly bears in Alaska. Anyway, make the story short. Herzog says nothing has to have a script when it comes to either TV or when it comes to cinema or when it comes to documentaries, whatever it is. So when we did ESPN, and after that, I did a little bit of program in Fox Sports. Yeah, that was pretty short, like 6 months. The other one was quite long, a bunch of years. We never had a script, never, ever. But when I said something and the guy directing said, I don't like it. You should do this, that, they change this, that. We kept all the time with the same phrase or the same script. But the script was done right there in the field. That's pretty cool. It makes it makes it more natural. Now, of course, you cannot, come up with the news without a script. Oh, come on. No. No way to do that. But yeah, for some things like this, documentaries, even some things regarding movies, pretty cool movies. Yeah. You're traveling worldwide, I know, and right now you're in Colombia, as far as from what you told me. This is a great TV series called Narcos. I don't know if you've seen it.
I have seen it. A lot of the people here in Colombia are not super excited about the show, but yeah, I've seen it.
Well, whatever. One of the two main characters there, he is Chilean. He is Pedro Pascal. And most of the scenes, they were not, you know, coming from a script. I mean, there's a lot of in the field, if you can call it that way, things coming up. That's pretty cool. That makes it really happy and better and easier. And it's a great series. It is very, very, very good. Yeah, and just terrible. Yeah, whatever. So you were saying about Nomas and Orvis. Yeah, that was a great time. That was a great time at both. I remember, I think the last time we met was in Manchester, Vermont. I think you were you were there with the CEO of at that time Orvis Travel.
I think it was you and Dave Parker and I.
Yep,
got together for sure.
Yeah, yeah. I think I'm not sure if I was on my own or in Francisco Rustagle, which he's still my buddy. He was with me. Yeah,
I think Francisco was with you.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah, he's a great guy. Living a little bit north of Santiago, about 400 kilometers. That's roughly 320 miles north of Santiago since quite a long time. He's into the gym business. Believe it or not. Okay. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. All right. Very cool.
I kept on the same thing as you you said. That is, tourism, actually luxury travel. So I kept booking people coming in. I did a lot of incoming, very ultra luxury, very high end, even fly fishing. And at a certain time, my old friend, she's a very nice woman. She's Mexican, Emire Vargas. She asked me to join her at Viajes Temisco. That was about 6 or 7 years ago, maybe probably 8. And I joined about 6, and then we had COVID, which was a big disaster. You know, Chile was probably one of the most closed countries on the planet. We couldn't put anyone from outside, like for like 1.5 years, almost 2 years. So yeah, I don't know if you get any noise on the background. No,
absolutely. Oh. So Pablo, let's do this, because I think that our listeners might want to just get kind of a clear picture of what you're doing. I mean, I heard you mention, you know, kind of a high-end ultra, high-end luxury folks. Yeah. Can you give us kind of a quick recap of what you're doing now? And then I want to go back in time a little bit and figure out how you got to this point. So how would you describe what you're doing now?
Yeah, you want to go back when I was a young guy. There you go.
Yeah, we're going to talk about your relationship with your mother and what went wrong for you to end up in tourism, basically. But in the meantime, what are you doing now? How do you describe what you're doing now in this space?
Okay, let me start a little bit before that. My family, actually, my dad's family, they run the hotel. So when I was 0 years old, I was inside a hotel.
You went way back.
Yeah, my friend. And that means, no, I didn't end disgracefully in this industry. I really like it. It's a lot of fun, a lot of very nice people. Well, you, Dave, I have very good memories of Dave. And I can keep going. What I'm doing now is, the company is based in Mexico, Temixco. That's Morelos State. And Emire decided to invite me as a partner. So I joined her. I invited somebody else here in Chile, which is Pablo Casés, with some little shares also to join. He's Argentinian. We have a very close relationship. Chile and Argentina, as you probably well know, and that not only relates with fly fishing, it relates with many other things. I would say it's even stronger than what we have with Peru. Yeah, probably the strongest. So we get along pretty well the last years, although Argentina is not doing very good these days. And well, since decades, whatever it is. And so I joined Emiret to push most of what Temisco was doing in Mexico, either in Chile, Argentina, Peru, and some other parts of Latin America. Brazil is kind of tough for me. Although I used to work ages ago for a Brazilian company, I speak very little Portuguese. Whatever it is, next step is the U.S., and that's our focus for this 2024. We organize and we tailor-made trips. It could be a ship. It could be, I don't know, you want to sit on an evening with a very high-end chef of, let's say, Chile, or it could be in Colombia. Colombia has pretty good chefs and pretty good restaurants. In that evening with that chef, you want to sit down in a specific place, which has a lot of architecture behind. So you want to sit down with probably the best architect of the country. So what we do is we organize all this. Or you want to grab a chopper, just you and your girlfriend or whoever it is, and, you know, go to some specific place to do a, I don't know, it could be photography, it could be, yeah. Well, of course, I have some, you know, areas in tourism. Yeah, some markets or niches that I understand a lot. One is, as you well know, fly fishing. The other one is photography. You know, I've been into photography for ages. And there's some others I well know as well. Wine. Before studying business, I studied enology. So I do know a lot about that. Many friends here in Chile. And same in Argentina, which is a great place for wines as well. Well, the U.S. as well. Napa, you have Oregon. And you can keep going, France and Italy, da-da-da. It's a, yeah, it's a great. So that is what we do. We organize very special, very unique trips to some very specific requests. Now, sometimes we just get a request for a luxury hotel, like a very good friend, a classmate at the university that called me about a couple of months ago, said, Paulo, I want the very best hotel in Madrid. And I said, well, look, there's no very best. It all depends what you're looking. What are you looking for? And he said, da, 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 da. I said, okay, but what you're looking for, Four Seasons. That's the one I would suggest. But there's a bunch of pretty good hotels in Europe. Well, same place, same thing in the U.S. And same thing here. Chile has... probably the most luxury properties here in Chile are focused mostly in nature. Well, that is the main thing. When you come to Chile, you're not coming here for, you know, the Incas. We don't have Incas. We have Mapuches, and it's not the same. Yeah, interesting, yes, but by far not the same. You come because of the wilderness, you know, or because of the sightseeing, or because of fly fishing, or because of you're looking for great waves and a little bit south of Santiago, or you're looking for whatever. Yeah, could be photography or wines, wine tourism. That is what we do. Yeah, it is mostly Mexican clients, but it's a huge market, very interesting, and it's really easy, very easygoing people. Very easy compared to other markets. Probably the easiest I've ever worked with.
Why is that?
Besides that, go ahead.
Why do you think that is? Why do you think the Mexican market is so much easier than other markets you've worked with?
Probably they're happy people. Brazilian people are easygoing people too, for working in tourism. Yes, they're very happy, even with. With what they have, I mean, very few places in Mexico that you can go at night without any risk. I would say Very, very few. It's a great country anyway. And it's people really enjoy life. And it's the same thing in Brazil. Where you are, yeah, pretty much the same as well. Colombia is one of the happiest probably countries in Latin America, I would say. Brazil is by far the happiest. I don't have any doubt at all. But probably number two is Colombia. I'm talking about South America. Right. And probably that is the reason why. Yeah, they're very easy. Really, they don't whine for anything. It would be very rare. They really like everything, but you got to do your job. I mean, they're not dummies. They know what they're asking and they're looking for. And of course, you cannot cheat anyone in Mexico. They would really go, I wouldn't say mad or crazy, but they were blind.
Not a smart choice. And I can relate. It resonates. What you're saying resonates with me. Just my limited traveling in Latin America, but specifically Mexico and Colombia, you know, I've spent a fair amount of time in both places. And yeah, I think that the people that I've come across are just, they're experiential. They're, you know, whether that's sharing time with friends and family. I love that I can just go out on the street and, you know, sit in front of a tienda with, you know, 15 other people all sitting around BSing, having fun with each other, you know, doing shots of aguardiente or whatever it is. They just seem so happy and they want to experience life. And I think that that's a perfect candidate for pretty much any of the types of trips and things that we're discussing doing, because it's all about experiences. So that makes sense.
Yeah, that is what we try to achieve when anyone asks for something that is tailor-made. You know, to get something that is stress-less, easy, happy, joyful, and probably that you will remember it for, if not your whole life, but for a very long time. I would say that's something that is easy with Mexicans and Colombians. I mean, they're happy people. Chile is not that happy. We're pretty critic. Yes. Yeah, we are very critic. Well, I'm Italian, so I mean, they go like, you know, and Argentina are pretty critic. But I would say they're happier than we are. I mean, Argentina's been having a hard time for the last 3-4 decades. And you go there and they keep going with asados, parrillas, they call it parrillas, which are the barbecues. And they keep going with the wines and laughing and dancing tango. And they're very friendly. And yeah, my two partners in another business I have here, which is, headhunting company, both of them Argentinian. Actually, one is Pablo, which I invited also to Viajes de Mixco, and the other guy is Silvio Savoldi, great guy. They both used to work for Unilever for decades in C-level positions. Very nice guys and easygoing, simple, happy. Pablo and Silvio have been living here for like 22 or 23 years. Yes.
Okay, and they're living in Chile now.
Oh yeah, yeah. Emilia, okay. my other partner, she lives in Mexico.
Right.
And actually right now she's in Antarctica traveling.
Oh. Okay. Very cool.
Well, we travel a lot. As I was telling you off camera. I used to travel like 9 months out of 12 for like 10, 11 or 12 years. It was over 1,000,000 miles a year. It was crazy, you know, pushing sales for Nomads of the Seas, getting some either charters or FITs. For those who do not know, FITs, frequent independent traveler, could be families as well. So, yeah, I traveled over 100 countries. Yeah, over 40, I think it's 43 or 44 states in the U.S., which is pretty impressive for even for Americans. I know.
Oh, yeah. I think the typical American, maybe, I don't know, the average is probably 6 or 7 10? States, I would guess.
Really?
Yeah, I think it's pretty low.
For example, I was listening to something that happened yesterday in Iowa. I don't know Iowa. I've never been to Kansas as well. Ohio, neither. I would say the West Coast, all of it, central part, most of it, the upper part, of course, because of fly fishing. I mean, how could I miss Montana? Yeah, I love Montana. I really love Montana. Yes.
Actually, there's a couple things I wanna learn about you, and this is a good opportunity to bring that up. So let's go back to year zero. You were born into hospitality. It sounds like literally.
Almost. Yeah.
And there's a couple things that really became super important for you. And some of this comes from what you've already mentioned here on the show, but some of it's just because I know you. And one is fly fishing. Yeah. And the other probably that I think is worth discussing at this point is photography. And then maybe just the travel in general. How, like, I've always wondered, like, you, because you were born in a hotel in Italy. Tell me a little bit more about the story.
No, my grandfather came to Chile and he raised a hotel a little bit south of Santiago in a very high-end area at that time frame. Not now. It changed a lot. I'm talking about almost 100 years ago. So he came up with a hotel, which was almost a whole square, huge, over 100 rooms, very high-end. He was Italian and he was from Piemonte. He was an engineer and very smart guy. And yes. So when I was very, since I was born, I was visiting the hotel every time from December till March, couple of months a year. That was until I was 16. At that time, they decided the hotel had to be they had to sell it. Sale were no good. The place did change a lot. It went from very high end to not very high end. But anyway, I remember many things from there. But I did not get into the tourism business since someone, when I started the fly shop here in Santiago, someone asked me to guide him. Actually, that someone was a former president of the U.S. I'm not kidding you. Jimmy Carter was he was my client. Actually, no one, but two times. And the first time, someone from the U.S. Embassy contacted the fly shop. And I said, well, why not? So we came up and it was a great thing.
So what was your connection with the fly shop? What was your connection with the fly shop?
I started the fly shop with two other friends.
Okay, so it was your business. Okay.
I was 30, I think. And I was a manager of another company on a totally different business, which was a transportation company related with either trucks. You know, Rockwell International, we were the representative of them here in Chile. And Marco Polo, which is one of the two or three largest bus company, they're based in Brazil, Caxias do Sul, that's in the southeast. The thing is, we started a fly shop and they started asking me for trips. So someone learned that I had guided. Actually, not me, but we were three. Yeah, I was a head guy there. And they kept me asking me for guiding. I was a manager, finance manager, actually. So, things happen in life, as my English grandfather said, for good, all time. I'm absolutely convinced of that. Look at you. You're in Colombia. You're traveling worldwide. I mean, you're getting a great life. When I met you, you were behind a desk, like this.
I don't know that that's the image I want to portray, but yeah, I know what you mean. There was a cubicle. Yeah. There was a cubicle involved.
Well, anyway, Orv is a great company for working at. Yes, I agree. I'm just putting it funny, but whatever.
No, I know.
So things happen for good. So I used to be the finance manager of Yamaha, and one day they said, Paulo, the company is not going well, so you got to go. This is a different company than the one I was telling you on transportation. But once again, engines, Yamaha, you know, Yamaha is mostly musical instruments. People don't mm-hmm. know that. Okay. Yeah, it's around 70-80% of the business.
Really?
I mean, it used to be. Probably it changed a lot. Whatever. And I was out of Yamaha one Friday, and I said, what I'm going to do. And then, dunk, guide. And I started guiding.
Now, yeah, I used to. But were you fishing before that? Or?
Oh, yeah.
Tell me how you got into fly fishing. We got to mix that in. So, because you went from, I worked at Yamaha to I opened a fly shop to I took Jimmy Carter fishing and I got lost.
Yeah. let me put it together. We call that in Spanish disperso. Okay.
Okay.
I mean you're dun. Okay, uh-huh. Let me put it together. Yeah, my grandfather Italian came up with a hotel. I used to visit the place most of the time, so I got involved with the industry since I was a kid. Then I studied first analogy, then I studied business, got an MBA, then I started working in the banking business, moved to the transportation business, and there I was in this company that had Rockwell International as a rep here in the country, and then I moved to Yamaha. Well, there's another one in the middle, but whatever. I moved to Yamaha, and I stopped being a CFO, and I said, what the hell? What am I going to do? So I started guiding because I was guiding before. So why was guiding before? My grandfather, the owner of the hotel, had taught me fly fishing when I was, I don't know, 7. And my dad, who did not fly fish and did not fish, actually, he didn't hate it, but it was boring. He took me fishing all the time. And he didn't do it. I mean, mm-hmm. I mean, yeah, that's the way a father is, a good father is, whatever it is. Mm-hmm. And yeah, that's the way I became involved with fly fishing. When I was at the university, to put it clear, my second career, after, you know, dating a lot of ladies and having a lot of fun, I decided it was time to get back to fly fishing. That was when I was like 22, 21, 23, mm-hmm. More or less. And so I grabbed a teacher. It was an Italian teacher to teach me about casting. I think it was a second lesson, and I was teaching the Italian teacher. he was like this, you know. Yeah. I mean, remember the newspaper? Just terrible. Well, whatever. Mm-hmm. But he's a great guy. I still talk with him, still, even these days. Yes. And then, well, I did whatever I told you. I started guiding. And in the middle, when I started the fly shop, I was a CFO. I started as a side business. We started traveling to the International Fly Tackle Leader Show, where I started meeting a lot of people and getting friends. I don't know. Steve Rager. He mm-hmm. is a longtime friend of myself. Tim Rager. Same thing. Even Joan Wolf, I don't know how old is she now, but she must be 90-something probably. Yeah, I remember meeting his son at the company. Then meeting Tom Rosenbauer and Orvis. Mm-hmm. I still keep talking with Tom. Dave Whitlock, he passed mm-hmm. away. He passed away a couple of years ago. Very nice man. And yeah, very longtime friend of Dave Hughes, the writer, Engel. I can keep going. Mel Krieger. That's why I brought Mel here. And yeah, I started becoming friends with a lot of people. the past owner of Scarfly Rod Company, da da da. So it's a mix of things getting together. So once again, things happen all the time for good, always.
That is fun. I'm really happy I dug into that, because this is stuff I did actually not know about you. And even back in the day when we were, you know, discussing fishing and putting together fishing packages and programs to Chile, I knew that you seemed excited about fishing. I did not make the connection. I mean, honestly, Pablo, I thought, okay, you're a marketing guy. You're really good at the marketing thing. You're working for a fly fishing destination in a sense. And you knew how to talk the talk and you seemed to walk the walk, but I didn't put it all together. So I'm happy to share that, because when you mentioned, you know, school, you know, college when you were younger, and then you decide to get back into fishing. I remember, you know, I was slightly non-traditional college student. I'd gone and done some stuff in the Army for a while. And then when I went back to school, I had a really hard time going to class because I was in Montana, going to, you know, Montana State University, and I'd be walking to class and the weather was too nice. It's like, oh man, the weather is really good. I would literally just walk right past the classroom. I'd walk home, grab my stuff, jump in the car and go fishing. So I would have done
the same. I don't blame you. I would have done just the same. Let me tell you something. Sometimes when I was a CFO getting big bucks, I grabbed a plane on Friday evening,
nice.
Flew to the south. Saturday, Sunday, dun 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 dun. And Monday morning, first plane. I don't know, 5 a.m. I was here. Got to my apartment, got a shower. Boom, to work. It was crazy. Yeah. The good news.
You and I are a lot alike. Except I was never in the spot where I could just go get a plane and take off. But I do remember weekends.
Well, you
weekends
you were,
like that.
Man, you were in Montana. Montana is a fly fishing mecca, just as Patagonia.
Well, that's why I was there. I chose that.
Yeah.
But it wasn't good for school.
Let me keep going with what I was telling you. I think it's going to be interesting for you.
Yeah.
And for the guys going to hear and listen this to the podcast. Maybe they're just going to...
That's good, okay. Stop. We're just here. If they're listening, that's great. If they're not, we're still having a good time. So,
well, whatever. I became friends with a lot of very, very well-known people, legions of the industry. Still, unfortunately, some of them passed away. Like Gary LaFontaine. I knew him. Yes. He was not my friend, but I knew him. And he knew me. Yes, I know. I met with a lot of Argentinian friends, nice guys, very nice people, and some people from Canada, a few of them from the UK. Remember the owner of Partridge, the Hooks, very nice guy, very, very funny guy. Some people from Austria, Italy, Spain. It was a lot of fun. So, yes, I really improved my casting. I think I'm a good caster. Not the very best, but good, yes. And I improved techniques and presentation and, yeah, everything. Fly tying, yes, I mean, I'm good, but I hate it. It's time consuming.
Yes, I can relate to that.
It's time consuming. I mean... Yeah, it's a lot of fun, but come on, I'm into fishing. Now, I created the first and probably the largest Spanish web with another guy. It was called Rios y Senderos website. Hmm. That was year 2000. And then about the year 2010 or 2008, I created the first certification for guides regarding fly fishing in Chile. Tim Brady can tell you about that. We ran a lot of programs. Actually, there were like 8 or 10 with the university. At some point, the guys of the IFFF contacted me for, trying to make something or merge something. but nothing happened at the end. So, yes. And then when the new law regarding fly fishing in Chile was being, worked, I worked on that intensively for a long time. I did help some of the largest here in promotion. Very few of them did good promotion, and still very few. I would say Gonzalo Cortez was probably one of the only ones that did it. And the one that you also had at Orvis, by the way, the GM there, Manuel Reyes, you probably remember Manuel.
It's Patagonia Baker, right? Or
yes.
No.
There you go.
Was it? Yeah. I think so. Yeah.
Manuel was a GM of Patagonia Baker. Actually, he had some shares there. He's not there anymore. He's at Marri Marri. He's a longtime friend of myself, and I'm the one that certified Manuel on fly fishing as a fly fishing guide.
I remember a specific fish that I caught with him the first day that I was at Patagonia Baker. He took me down to a spot, and I remember that very well. He's a great guy. I need to get him on the show.
I'll let you know the contact and all that. Yeah, I'm helping Manuel right now with Marri Marri on the south, which is a very high-end property. It's a villa, actually. It's a beautiful place. They have two choppers for fly fishing. Yeah, very nice place. Yeah, you must come down here, Jason, and go fishing. Oh, man, yeah, that's for sure. Yeah, we can.
Sounds good.
And we can do, we can do another conversation live from... You just come here in April this year, and I'll bring you to a place you will never, ever forget. Now, if you want to go fly fishing.
All right. Well, that sounds like a deal, and I've got it recorded. So,
April. It's got to be April this year. Yeah, we got to. Yeah, the other thing is a lot of people still call me saying, where should I go? What should I do? And, I traveled this country very, very, trust me, very much. That is why Andres contacted me and contracted me for over 10 years in Nomads. I knew the fjords. I knew the fishing, where the fish were, not all of them. And Osvaldo and Walter, which is a longtime friend of myself, he really helped me with the first fly fishing certification here in the country. He knew some other places as well, so it was a pretty good combination. Osvaldo's a very nice guy, living in Frutillar in the south and enjoying life. He's retired. I'm going to retire next year, but I want to retire and get the money from who is going to pay me, but I'm going to still keep working, man. Yeah, of course. I mean, yeah.
Hey, Pablo, let's do this because I think that Nomads of the Seas was a fascinating thing. I think I took at least three groups down there over the course of 2 or 3 years. And I just thought it was super, super cool. And I'm sure that a lot of people that are listening to this have no idea what we're talking about when I say Nomads of the Seas. And since you did such a great job promoting it and helping develop that program, I'd love to have you describe what it was. And any other things that you think are exciting that are kind of like that, or just what mark do you think that left on fishing in Chile?
For those who do not know about Nomads, Andres, the owner, his father as well, they're both the owners. He is one of the biggest, not the biggest, he's one of the main shareholders. One of the big banks here in Chile. So, and he is just nuts about fly fishing. He's a very good fly fisherman. Yeah, very smart guy as well. And probably the most creative ever guy I've ever met. So he thought after traveling a lot with Osvaldo, the best way for approaching this very hidden spot was with choppers. But how would you get there with choppers? I mean, gravel roads, cities, no cities. I mean, it was impossible. So he thought the only way to approach with a chopper those places was with a ship. The ship was called the Atmosfera, for those Spanish listeners, atmosphere in English. Yeah, actually, it was called The Atmosphere in English. And the company was called Nomads of the Seas because we were moving everywhere through the ocean. Actually, not the ocean, fjords. That part of Chile is probably, and in my opinion, and I know, once again, this country very, very much, the most beautiful part of Chile. Although it rains. And when it rains, man, it rains. And it rains a lot. The woods are just like those that you have in BC, British Columbia. It's called the cold temperate forest. So what the ship did is it sailed through the fjords, anchored in very stable places. The ocean there is not rough at all. It can be a little bit rough in one pass, the Corcovado Gulf, actually. That's it. The fishing is very good. Unfortunately, it's mostly lagoons and lakes and some rivers and a few spring creeks, which are just amazing. As much as the ones that you know in Montana, Nelson's, Armstrong, and the Pew. I know them very well, the three. Mm-hmm. And you live there, man, but I've been there a billion times. Yeah, I know Yellowstone and all the area, and Yellowstone Angler, and Jim Branga that used to work there. And yeah, you can keep going.
Pablo, I don't remember if you and I ever mentioned it, but since you just brought it up, I get to mention that I managed Turner Flats in Belize, that I know, but also I was there, Yellowstone Angler. I worked with Jim Brungart at the Yellowstone Angler. He was one of my mentors. So when I was going to school at Montana State, walking past class to go fishing, my job was, you know, I was working at the Yellowstone Angler with George and Jim and Brant. And
Brant, I know the whole crew. Yeah, Brant also. Yep. Yeah, great guy. Yeah.
Yep.
Well, I know you were at Turniff, which is a great place. I was there 1 year and a half ago with Craig. Craig actually had a knee surgery. I don't know if you know that.
No.
He had a knee replacement. Oh, yeah. Yes. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. I don't know how he's doing. Yeah. Last time I was there, I left Turner Flats. 2 days after I left, big hurricane. Big. Well, not that bad. I mean, I was very lucky. I was there like 12 days doing photography. Of course, fly fishing, but doing photography.
That's fun.
You know what, Jason? I enjoy nowadays more. Well, I enjoy fly fishing myself. I enjoy casting a lot. Yes, with a one hand fly rod, not two.
Okay.
And not tencaras or stuff like that. No, the regular classic fly fishing. But I enjoy a lot making some other people catch fish. Sight fishing. And so that's why I enjoy a lot saltwater fly fishing. I really enjoy the nervous water, you know, the tailing perm and, you know, even the kudas, which are just great on the fly rod. Well, if you're using the proper gear, otherwise you're dead.
Yeah.
Whatever. Nomads, getting back to what you said, Nomads is still running, although only by charter. It's a ship that sails from Puerto Montt, which is 1,000 kilometers south of Santiago. I'm sitting right now in Santiago, the capital, and has two choppers on the stern, sitting on the stern, Bell 407. And it has capacity for 28 guests. And I usually recommend that never over 24. And one fly fishing guide for two clients. So it's a big crew for the whole people there. Very high-end wines, very high-end meals. Well, probably one of the best in the country.
Guillermo Rodriguez. Yeah.
Yes, Guillermo Rodriguez still in charge of that. Andres is selling it nowadays only by charters. He doesn't sell any FITs, and he does a lot of charters. Well, this thing sails through the fjord, so everyone can understand. And every day you get a ride in the morning, then you're taken back for lunch, or you could have lunch on site, and then you have a second ride in the evening or on the afternoon for fly fishing in the afternoon. not at night. You're not allowed to fly choppers in Chile at night. No, it's against the law. And we're very strict on in what comes to being respectful with the law in Chile, which is very different than the rest, all of the rest of Latin America. Oh, yeah.
Yeah, I didn't know that you could not fly a helicopter at night in Chile. That's interesting.
You cannot unless you have a very special permit, and it takes quite a while to get it. Yes. Okay. Yeah, you cannot. You cannot. Yeah. The operation started, it was like 16 years ago, maybe 14 years ago. I'm not sure.
Has it been that long?
Yes. Yeah.
Oh, my goodness. Yeah. Yep.
That long. So, yes. And getting back to Montana, Jimbo is a longtime friend of myself. He's now living in Idaho, as you well know. You will know. He's in charge of a club or whatever it is. And we get in touch every now and then. And he is a great guy. Yes. I really like Montana. If you ask me, what would I choose instead of Patagonia? That would be Montana. It wouldn't be Alaska. It's so special. Not only the big skies, which we do have here in the South as well. It's everything. It's the history. It's the mountains. It's the wildlife. It's very special. I fly fish because I really get a big feeling, and it's a really nice feeling when I'm fly fishing. It's just an excuse for, listening the silence, listening to the birds. Enjoying the green or whatever it is, could be brown if you're fishing in the Argentinian side where the pampas are, which is beautiful as well. And feeling the water, feeling the cold water in your feet. And it's the same thing in the Caribbean. You're feeling the breeze, you're feeling the nervous water. You're talking to your guide in the back, which is usually most of the time speaking Creole. which for me, at the beginning, it was a mess, but yeah, I got used to it. It's a beautiful, it's not a sport. It's an art. It's a way of life. Absolutely. It's a way of life. Yeah.
I'm happy we had this conversation because you're definitely bringing back a lot of, memories and fond thoughts of my time on the water, both guiding people and being guided, and some friends. We've got a lot of I knew that we had some mutual connections. I don't think this is probably the longest real focused conversation I've had with you. So it's been a great opportunity to kind of to connect and realize how much we actually have in common. So I need to. So it sounds like I need to come down to Chile in you said April, right?
Yeah.
Okay.
Oh yes.
Yep. We'll do that over a Pisco Sour. I remember on Nomads, I learned about the Piscola, which is Pisco and Cola.
They call it Cuba Libre, Free Cuba, because it's Coca-Cola.
But it's Pisco instead of rum, right? So it's weird. Yeah. I have some fond memories of being on the ship, and you mentioned the food and the helicopters are just, oh my gosh. I just being on those helicopters. And I remember maybe it was the first year I went down. I think I remember his name, but I'm not going to mention it here because I'm not 100% sure. But I think one of the pilots had flown for Pinochet back in the day or something that.
No.
Is that just a story?
You're right, but not a pilot. Osvaldo Anguante, my friend, I'm not a right-wing guy. Well, I'm not a left-wing guy. Yeah,
Osvaldo used to be, that worked for? Yeah, okay. And I heard some stories that we're not going to share here because
he used to be the bodyguard. And I don't like Pinochet at all. I mean, he did good things, but in human rights, he was just terrible. Yeah. Yeah, he was a Pablo Escobar within the army.
Yeah, yeah.
Not that bad, but whatever. It's not the comparison. It's not a proper one. Anyway, if Osvaldo listens to me, he will go mad.
Yeah, we're not going to. I just remember having some conversations, and he's a super interesting guy. I probably should have him on the show as well if he's still around. Yeah,
I'll let you know. Stuff. Yes.
That'd be cool.
Osvaldo is living in Frutillar. Yeah, he's very fluent in German, and he's pretty fluent in English as well. Yes,
That's fun.
The guy that flew the chopper was Francisco Esquivel.
Francisco, yeah, I was right. I remember him.
He used to be the pilot of Michelle Bachelet, our former president. The lady.
Okay, I got it. I remember. Okay, pilot. Yeah, it was for the president. Yeah, okay. And he was good. I've been on helicopters. I was in the Army. Great. I was an Army Pathfinder, spent a lot of time on helicopters and doing air traffic control with helicopters. Very familiar with helicopters, just short of being a pilot. And I remember how impressed I was by Francisco. Some of the places he picked us up in, and I was like, wow, he's really, really, he's like, he's got the door open, hanging out the door to look backwards as he's reversing to get out of the spots.
Yeah.
Yeah. A lot of good memories.
Andres is a very good chopper pilot.
He's good too.
Well.
Yeah.
Very, very good. He's the pilot, the planes. Military planes, actually. Air Force planes, Andres.
Okay.
Yeah. And he is a very, very, very skilled chopper pilot. He's good on fly fishing as well. Smart. Yeah, it was a great time working with Andres at Nomads of the Seas. Very good time. Yeah. Very good time. I really worked my, not very polite work, but I worked my ass during those 10 to 12 years there. Actually, when I quit, a lot of people said, did you sell your shares? And I said, what shares? Come on, you're not an owner? I said, no.
No, I just worked like one.
you're not a shareholder? No. I said, well, I thought you were a shareholder. No. But yes, I really like what I did. Well, yeah. I love what I do as well now. I travel a lot. Not as I did at that time, but I do travel a lot. And it's been recovering. It was really, really slow. Fortunately, I have some other businesses. Otherwise, I would be dead. You wouldn't be talking to me. But it is recovering here and it is recovering worldwide. And that's pretty good. Yes. I just came back from a trip. I think I told you I was in Cannes. There's a very famous luxury travel show there. It's called ILTM, International Luxury Travel Market. From there, I moved to Paris, where my oldest daughter lives. She has a PhD at La Sorbonne, Claudia. She lives there. She's pretty good on artificial intelligence and cybersecurity. She's one of the best, actually. And from there, I moved then to Venice. From there, I moved to Rome. Back to Madrid and then back to Santiago. That was almost a month ago, a week ago, I came back, yes.
So you're still bouncing all over around the place. I've asked you a bunch of questions. We've had quite a conversation.
Yeah, you were asking me about photography.
Yeah, okay, good. You didn't forget. Yeah. So, all right, so let's discuss that a little bit. I know it's a passion of yours.
Yeah, let me tell you this, Jason. I used to be a teacher at the university for like 25 years, teaching either marketing, finance, and at the end, I taught a lot about sustainability, and I'm not talking about the real one. And that was 20 years ago when I was teaching the students, and then I'm going to get to photography. When I was teaching the students how the rain was going to behave, why the planet was going to, get warmer and da-da-da. You know I'm a green guy, very deep green, yes. They went like, I remember looking at the faces like, this jerk, he is crazy, but whatever. And I've met these guys 20 years after that. And I go like, Professor, Professor, yeah, you were right. You were right. Everything you told us 20 years ago is happening. And I go like, unfortunately, yes, I was right.
Yeah. It's so, one of those deals where you wish you'd been wrong, huh?
Yeah, I know. Well, photography, my dad, he was an ophthalmologist, MD, medical doctor. So when I was 6 or 7, I was gifted a photographic camera. Of course, it was a Kodak. That doesn't exist now. Mm-hmm. Weird. It was a plastic Kodak with a roll, with a film, and whatever.
Yep, I remember those.
me too, but I'm older than you are. Well, whatever. So I was 6, 7. So why? Well, my father taught optics at the university for like 50 years. Mm. And he was a very, very good photographer and very good cinematographer, both. I'm not into videos, but yes, into photography. So he was my teacher. And I don't know. Since then, I've been shooting and shooting and shooting. And I keep shooting and actually shooting with this, which is, the cell where you get the you capture whatever you capture is still very small. And the ones you get with a Nikon, I use a D850, and I'm going to move to the mirrorless very soon, in a few months, which means changing most of the lenses. I mean, you can keep using the old lenses, but it doesn't make any sense. Photography is something that makes you see things in a way that otherwise you were never see them. You learn to open your eyes and see lines, shapes, shadows, lights, colors, contrasts. You learn to see the mess, and you learn to make that mess something that is readable by the one who looks at the picture. Actually, photography is the only art, and I've been talking about this for ages with Val Atkinson, which is a long-time mm-hmm. friend of myself. You know Val.
Mm-hmm. I fished with Val before. Yeah, yeah, he's great.
Yeah, me too. Me too. He's a great guy. Yeah. And photography is the only art in which you come up with a mess, whatever it is. It's a mess, and you have to start taking things of the mess. I mean, you won't grab them and put. I mean, I'm going to grab mm-hmm. that tree and put him out. No, you have to move yourself, change the angle, whatever it is. Yeah, it's framing. And there's a lot of art besides that involved. I mean, perspective, lights, contrast, expressions. I love portraits. I really love portraits. Actually, I think Val, the portrait he was using until a year ago, it was mine, the one I did from him. We're pretty close friends. Yes, we've been fishing in very different places. I invited him actually to Chile. That's the good thing about photography. Now, there's a bad thing about photography. Yeah, and it's pretty bad.
What's that? Share it with me.
Yeah, there is a movie. Jesus, I can't remember the name. He is not the main character, but Sean Penn is in the movie. It's a movie of the guy that used to work in behind the desk, and suddenly he decides to change everything. Well, in some section of that movie, Sean Penn is with a long telephoto. This will explain why photography can be bad sometimes. With a very long telephoto, it's not that big, but probably that big. And there's a snow leopard at what this guy is looking. And then comes this other guy kind of a nerd that was trying to explore the world he didn't know. And he started speaking with Sean Penn. I can't remember the name. I mean, if I look in my Mac, I could, but it's going to be a mess. So, no. Yeah. Let's keep it that way.
That's okay. You're telling a story. We don't need to know the specifics.
The story is nice. So this guy is sitting and chasing the snow leopard. You know snow leopards?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Very, almost impossible to get on a camera. Okay, so this guy is sitting, Sean Penn, and comes the other one. They start blah, 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 blah about some roles of films, whatever it is. And then the snow leopard shows up right in the middle of the frame and stays there. And Sean Penn calls the guy and says, look. And the guy says, no, you shoot. And Sean Penn says, no, look. So the other guy comes, looks, then through the viewfinder, and then Sean Penn looks once again, and then the snow leopard moves. And wow. He didn't shoot. Now, this is one of the greatest scenes regarding photography I've ever seen. What does it tell you? Most of the time, when you are a photographer, you're looking things with a photography eye. You're framing.
Right.
You're changing things. That is not really very restful. It's kind of stressing. Once in Nomads, when we were looking at blue whales that you know we had there, and a lot, Gianpaolo Sonnino, which was the marine biologist we had in charge mm-hmm. of the one of the big in charge of the big zodiac we had there. By the way,
I remember
we had
him.
For the other guys, we had a huge zodiac. It was a 920 top of the line zodiac, huge for like 18 to 20 people, with two Yamahas on the stern. Each Yamaha was, I think it was 350 horsepower, four stroke, whatever it was. Yeah, it really run. Yeah, really, whatever. We were looking at the blue whales, and I was shooting with my Nikon telephoto. And Gianpaolo comes very close to me and says, Paolo, yes, Gianpaolo, how many blue whales have you seen with your eyes?
Mm.
And I go like, shit. I go like, none. He said, well, bring the F camera, the F camera down and use your eyes. Yeah. That is the bad news about photography. And I would say most of photographers probably have to face that. We spoke about this with Val. And you learn, after a while, you learn the moment in which you have to say, okay, ciao camera. I'm done. Now, go ahead. You're going to ask something.
That's a really, really interesting story. And it's interesting that you mentioned Val specifically, because I remember I had led a couple trips that involved Val where we kind of brought him on as a guest, just because our clients just love spending time with him.
Orvis?
Yeah, we did some projects Orvis. In the Bahamas where I brought him along, and I remember he would sit there in the group. There'd be a group of us having conversation. He'd sit there with his camera on his lap. And just every once in a while, click, camera comes up, click, goes back in his lap. And he was really good at capturing those moments, kind of those spontaneous moments. They weren't staged. He was just kind of sitting there observing. And based on what your story that you just shared, it's causing me to kind of see that experience a little differently now. And I'm envisioning him there experiencing the conversation, experiencing the group through the lens of a photographer and looking for the shot. And maybe I'm not speaking for him, but maybe trying to capture the shot more than capture the moment on a more cerebral level. I don't know. What do you think?
Well, you should see the movie. I'm telling you. I mean, I should.
We got to figure it out.
Let me check here. I don't think it will.
Hold on. You keep telling stories. It's Sean Penn.
Wait a minute.
If we Google Sean Penn Snow
Leopard.
No.
I have it here. I'm checking here. Yeah. Hold it.
The Secret Life of Walter Mitty.
That's the one. Yes, ma'am. Yep. That's the one. That's it. Bingo.
All right. So anybody that's listening to this, now they don't have to go figure it out. The Secret Life of Walter Mitty. And I will check that out as well.
There is a great scene of Sean Penn with that. It is just amazing. Yeah, what that scene tells you is it's the same thing that Herzog said. No scripts. I mean, mm-hmm. Enjoy the moment. Be happy every moment. You know, the planet is so screwed up in many senses. Look at the wars. I mean, and look at climate crisis and biodiversity crisis, which is just terrible. I mean, and we're done with climate crisis. We're done. There's no way back. No point of return. No. Well, look at that. When you look at that, yes, you have to understand that you have to, of course, being respectful with everyone, respecting the laws and da da da. But you have to enjoy every single moment in life. And that scene is what is telling you. And that is what photography sometimes steals from you. You're so focused on getting the shot that you miss the whole thing. And let me tell you something. When you miss the whole thing, you miss the best shot. So
it's kind of metaphor for life in general, isn't it?
Yeah. It is. Yeah. Well, actually, with this thing, with photography, I've enjoyed many things, but I learned after a few decades that I had to take out my eyes of doing photography. Now, I enjoy photography as much as I enjoy fly fishing. Probably more. No kidding.
Yeah.
And the other thing I've been involved with since I was 8 is entomology, which is a weird thing. You know, fly fishing and entomology connect. Mm-hmm. And yes, I was deeply involved with entomology. That is why my first career was agronomy, although I studied enology, which is a specialization, but it was agronomy. Because of entomology and my love for ecology and all that. Yes. Yeah. I'm green. I'm very deep green. Not crazy, but green. Yeah, of course. And I think a lot of people in the fly fishing industry are that way. They love nature. And fly fishing is just an excuse. And it's a pretty good excuse. We use the expression sensual, which is more than sexy. What is more sexy than a fly line flying? It's like ballet. That's beautiful. And you're doing that on a beautiful setting most of the time. And with beautiful sounds most of the time, great smell. I mean, it's even when it rains.
It's an amazing excuse. Like you use the word excuse. I love that because I've often recognized that fly fishing specifically was an excuse for me to see things I never would have seen otherwise.
Yeah.
I mean, just the conversation you and I are having, if I just look at my end of this conversation, I've visited 30 plus countries now and I guarantee I'd probably be closer to 5 if it wasn't for fly fishing, because so many of those places I went were because I worked in the fly fishing industry, because I was excited and passionate about it, because I was leading a group, because I wanted to go tiger fishing in Africa, because I wanted to go, catch fish in New Zealand or whatever. And I got to see all these amazing places. I remember a few of the fish, but I remember the people a lot more. I remember the culture, the society, the lessons learned, and just the experiences so much more than the fish. And Yeah, like you say, it's just a great excuse to go do things.
Yeah, absolutely. That's what I like the travel business as well. Although this is luxury travel, which is even better. Luxury. Yeah, let me make, and this is a point probably interesting for the ones that will listen as. Luxury is a very difficult word to explain. A lot of people associate luxury with gold or Ferraris. I love Ferraris. Yeah, but that's not luxury. That's a commodity. And gold is a commodity. Actually, it is. it's a mineral, whatever. That's not luxury. Luxury is an experience. You could be, with a tin can and a very decent wine, probably chambray, which is at the proper temperature, even cold, but in a great location with a great friend, talking about great stories. Well, that's luxury. That is luxury. That is what I call soft luxury. The other is commodities, or you can call it hard luxury. Yeah, what we try to do is all the time in the company I'm associated right now is creating that soft luxury for everything that we do. And that is one of the things I created when I guided or, managed some guided trips here in Chile with, some famous people. I guided some famous people.
I really, really like the way you said that. So what I heard you say was, luxury is, I kind of want you to say it again. Luxury is not a commodity. It's an experience. You use the word experience, right?
Yeah. Luxury is creating something that is unique. Experiences cannot be, replied. You cannot repeat the same thing 10-20 times. A service could be repeated, but not an experience. That's a big difference between services and experiences. And in luxury, the real luxury is not about gold or Ferraris, which I love. It could be a Porsche or whatever it is, or Rolex. Yeah, that is not luxury. That is hard goods, hard stuff that is not luxury. That can contribute to luxury? Maybe. What about a dish? A good dish. A risotto. Risotto with fungi. Done it in a proper way. You can have the risotto in a terrible dish, or you can have the same risotto in a beautiful dish. Sitting in a beautiful place in Venice, where I was. I want to put it this way. The Aperol Spritz, which is actually not from Venice, but from other place in Italy. Yeah, that's another Spritz, which is the Aperol, which is the real one in Venice, whatever. I had an Aperol Spritz at the terrace of the St. Regis at Venice, where I was invited and staying. Looking at the Grand Canal with one of the managers of the hotel. Do you think, or how could you compare that with Leonardo? Great guy, great friend. How could you compare that with, a room with cold in some parts? And I don't know, it has no comparison. One is an experience. The other is a hard thing.
Yeah, I get I get what you're saying. And I absolutely agree. I think,
this is what we run. You know, Virtuoso, right?
Yeah.
Yeah. Okay. We are members of Virtuoso and I'm a Virtuoso travel agent, or travel consultant, or put it the name you want. That is one of the things we're trying to redefine in Virtuoso. A lot of people still are on the old thinking of the gold and the Ferrari, and no, it is very different. I remember Michael Keaton downloading his private jet in Puerto Montt in Chile for getting on board of Nomads of the Seas. You know what he did when he pulled out of the jet, his private jet? He started picking pieces of papers that were on the floor. That is very simple. And it was a very simple guy. What did he enjoy? The ship, the chopper? No, he enjoyed the rides, the talking, the nature. You were there? No.
No, but I worked with him in Montana, and he's cut from a different bolt, and I appreciate it. Yeah.
Yeah, no. Well, whatever. I remember Tim Rajic with him and teaching him fly casting. Tim was on board at that time. And Tim actually has a video in which he is teaching Michael Keaton, which is a shitty caster. Yes. He's a great actor, but shitty caster. Teaching Tim Rajic, teaching one of the best on fly casters ever. I mean, Steve has been world champion, I don't know, a billion times. And Tim is almost the same, although he doesn't compete that much. Well, whatever. Tim Rajic teaching Michael Keaton how to fly fish. And he was like, I remember seeing, pick and drop, pick, drop, pick. No, don't move the wrist. Yeah, that was fun. Well, yeah. that is an experience. Yeah. And that is luxury. It is a whole combination of soft things, not the hard Ferrari or the hard gold.
I guess it's the difference between the word, you know, tangible and intangible.
Yeah.
Right, well, in a sense.
But it's more than that.
Yeah.
It's more than intangible. But yeah, well, we sell intangibles, not tangibles. Yeah, that is why it's so difficult to sell them. I mean, you don't sell the night of the hotel today. Ciao, you're done. I mean, it's gone.
Yeah. You sell the experience of what you're.
You don't sell this iPhone 15 today. Well, you save it for tomorrow. You can sell it tomorrow. Well, that's not the thing with intangibles. Well, with some, yes. Yeah, saving. I mean, an insurance. You could set it the next day.
I see what you're saying. It's not as simple as tangible and intangible.
Yeah.
But it's that like you just described this experience with Michael Keaton and Tim Rajic. That's not something that you can put your hands on. It's an experience, right?
Yeah. Of course. It is. The real luxury is something that you really enjoy, memorable. Probably it would last for a lifetime or for a very long time as a very good memory. Could be a very bad experience as well, of course. I'm talking about the good ones. Yeah, that's the ones we're working for. But yeah, it does not have to do with what you're using. Let's say you're going for a permit, I don't know, a 22-pound permit, which is a big fish. They're bigger, but whatever. Yeah, I've seen bigger, whatever. Yeah. And, I mean, it will make a difference, the reel you have. Yeah, probably if it burns out and it doesn't have, but I mean, you could pay, I'm not going to say brands because I'm a good friend of many of those. But you could pay a lot of money for one, and maybe half or 30%. Now, is the experience different? No. Probably no. Unless you want to see the reel, and the reel is so nice, of course, yeah. Well, whatever. So, yes. But now, for building the soft luxury, of course, you need part of the hard things I was talking about. But they are not the real luxury. They are just builders of the experience. That is what... Yeah, I've been teaching this in marketing for marketing services, marketing is what I've been teaching. There's a guru there called Christopher Lovelock, and most of us who teach that use his book, which is probably the very best ever written. And yeah. So photography, cool. Again, photography again is a partner of fly fishing. Yes. And entomology. Yes. And luxury. Yes.
Because I do have to ask you this one question. Go. Back on luxury. And then we're going to probably wrap up here. But does luxury have to be expensive?
No. No, most of the time, yes. But no, the answer is no. You can do, it all depends on what we're talking about. I mean, if you're trying to do something luxurious in Venice regarding staying there and staying in a place, very difficult. I mean, I sent my partner to an Airbnb. He was in a great place. If you ask me, it was luxury, the place. No. The experience? Well, yeah, he had a terrace. Had a terrace, and he was looking at one of the channels, not the main channel, but one of the channels. And he was, calling me through WhatsApp from there saying, Paulo, I can't believe what we're so happy. This is luxury, of course. But yes, it all depends what you're looking for. But it can be cheap. Yes. Now, let me put it this way. You can pay a lot of money for hitting Turner Flats, a couple. I don't know, 12 grand. Couple? Yeah, it's around 12 grand, couple. Both fly fishing. Okay, that's a lot of money. Turner is luxury? Well, it all depends. Rooms, for me, are luxury. I mean, come on. You open the door, and the sea is right there. You walk, 20 feet?
We used to say if you tripped on the way down the stairs, you'd land in the ocean. it's close. Yeah.
Now, it is luxury. Once again, let's go to the fly fishing side. Okay, you get the skiff, and you get a great guy on the back. Polling, very good eyes, and he's spotting permit everywhere. And you got great weather for spotting permit, but perfect weather for, casting over permit, which, as you well know, they're extremely spooky. Extremely.
Yeah.
And so if you're a shitty caster, you don't land the fly properly, you don't do the cast in the position you need, well, you're done. Now, what if your guide is not the same guide, but it's a not very good guide with not very good eyes who doesn't know where the hell is the school of permit moving? He just saw one tail and it's going like, there, and the school is there. It moved. It is luxury. So once again, you're in the same skiff, the same pole. Well, the guy in the back, no, it's not the same, but you're in the same skiff, with the same pole, with the same fly rod, with the same reel, on the same lodge. And the fishing was shitty. Why? Because the guy wasn't good. No. Now, it is luxury? No. Or it did not achieve the standards. So once again, it is a full combination of things. So it must be expensive. Well, most of the time when you need to pay for the very good things, yes, you need to pay a lot of money. But not every time. Now, you can do many things on your own if you learn how to.
But there's probably some sort of investment, whether that's money to pay to get yourself there or the time and effort to learn the skills. Or to take the hike, to walk for 3 days to get away from the crowds because you can't afford the helicopter to get there. Yeah, okay.
Yes.
I'm with you.
Yeah. I agree. Yes, that's it. Yes. I mean, guides exist. Guides exist because of something. Artificial intelligence won't put guides out of business. No. And very few travel agents that are very specialized, they will keep in business. I use I personally use artificial intelligence. Let me tell you a short story. I don't know when we're done with the time, but you let me know, Jason.
You just you keep going. Someone's still listening, yeah. So.
Okay. The I had a media called me from Mexico saying, Pablo, I'm kind of stressed. I have a client, very important client from Mexico, that wants to travel to Belgium and to Holland. Well, to the Netherlands. Mm-hmm. And I said, okay, what does he want to do? He wants to make a trip by car. I said, okay. So what car? Yeah, he wants a good car, and he wants to drive himself with his girlfriend. He is easygoing, very wealthy, and likes things very well organized. Ah, he looks like an American. Well, he's Mexican. Okay. So I go like, in about 1 hour, I'll have the trip. And she goes like, you're kidding me. No. Bard. I prefer Bard. I'm not a big fan of Microsoft, so I try to avoid ChatGPT. So I went to Bard. Bard. Mm-hmm. Which are the most important cities I should visit in a 1 week trip in Belgium? Okay, saved. Which are the most important cities I should visit in Netherlands? Then. Look at this. Which is the roads I should take to connect all this? This is a road. Save. Then uh-huh. I get Google Maps and I put doom, 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 doom. Okay. Give me the roads. Boom. Boom. One. Belgium. Ready. Netherlands. Boom. Oh, okay. I have to put the guy out of Belgium, enter Netherlands, and then enter into Belgium once again. Ah, no problem. Piece of cake. I know the place, by the way. Of course, I knew what I was looking at. Mm-hmm. It's here. Oh, but it's in English. I said, use translator. It's a Google translator. It goes like this. Of course, you're going to have to change things, but mm-hmm.
It's a lot quicker and easier than doing it all from scratch.
I mean, it took me 1 hour. Yeah. At the most.
Yeah.
I mean, what it took me most was typing. Typing to ask. Then copy, boom, 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 boom. Okay. Then I had to reassign places and da, da, da. And then I asked, what does this guy like? Food, architecture, history, what? Sightseeing. Mm-hmm. There's some places which are great sightseeing, but you won't send anyone for sightseeing to Rotterdam. That's not sightseeing. It's a big port, huge, enormous. Yeah, there's some good museum. There's a nice museum, one nice museum there. No, but probably he wants that. That's a big city. Or how you call Brujas in English? I don't know the word for Brujas. Brujas. Yeah, it's a beautiful town, small town. Medieval town.
Bruges, Belgium? Bruges.
Yeah, Belgium. Yeah. You won't send anyone to Bruges, Belgium, if he's looking for museums. No, that is, there's some, but you will send it to Amsterdam, of course, there you get a bunch of those. So once again, it is a combination of things, just like luxury. It is a combination of things working on the industry. And for me, AI is a big help.
It's a great tool. I mean, when you and I are finished with this conversation, my system is going to use AI to go through and create a transcript. It's going to go through and create show notes with bullet points. And it saves me from sitting there listening to this conversation again with my pen and paper, writing down, what did we talk about? Let's outline it. Boom, boom, boom. And it'll take 5 minutes for AI to recap the conversation. I'll read it, obviously, just to make sure that, like, you know, something real weird's not coming up. But and that allows me to have more conversations with interesting people, to spend more time on the conversation with you instead of worrying, oh, well, I got to hurry up and wrap up this conversation so I can go do the show notes or the this or the that. So I think it's a great tool, and I've been using it for the podcast, and I've been using it for some of my clients to put together itineraries, mostly as an idea generator. And I think it's great for that. So
it is. Yes, I really like it. I really, really like it. I use it a lot for many things, even for the human resources and in a business in which I'm involved. Actually, that's I told you, headhunting. We use it a lot. We use it a lot. Yes, a lot.
Actually, real quick,
the
headhunting, is this tourism related headhunting? What is this? Because that might be something we want to touch on real quick.
We have a focus on sea level positions and mid positions. And I thought, and this was last year, hey, why don't we come up with, focus on tourism? And Paolo said, well, I think you know something about that. I said, yeah, I think too. So, yes. So right now, yeah, we're working some pretty good and big hotel companies here, actually three. And usually small companies like lodges and guys like that do not ask in Chile for headhunters. They just try and go themselves, which is a big mistake, but whatever. It's like going fly fishing without a guide. In Chile, a lot of people try to avoid that unless they're, floating a river and they need someone in charge of the oars. I don't agree with that. I think guides, when they really are professional, they really add. And that's all the time.
No, I agree. I agree completely.
All the time. You were a guide yourself. Me too. So yeah.
Mm-hmm.
All the time.
Yep. Makes a huge difference. And if I go somewhere, I'm going to hire a guide, even if I have to scrape together every last penny, because I'm going to have a totally different experience.
Of course.
And when I take my family or I go do things, it's like, I see the value. And it's interesting because before I'd never been with a guide. My first guide trip, I was guiding. I'd never been on a guide trip, and
really?
I remember we got to the takeout. I floated the river with these folks. I was back when I was working with Jim and Brant, floated the river. They caught some fish. We get to the takeout. I drop them off at their car and they said, wow, this was our first guide trip and you really set the bar high. And to this day, I wish that I'd looked at them and said, you know what? This was my first guide trip too. And you guys set the bar real high. Of course, I was too embarrassed to admit that it was my first trip, but it was,
How many years you lived in Montana?
Oh boy. Well, I was born and raised more or less in Wyoming, but I would say in Montana, actively fishing 7-8 years, probably total. I was in Montana before I went to work for Orvis. So I figured the only thing that would have ever taken me out of Montana was the opportunity to go work for Orvis. And only because it was the travel business. So I could fish in all these other exotic, amazing places. So it was worth it.
And you met Craig in Bozeman.
It's interesting because we meaning me and my girlfriend at the time, I was working for the Yellowstone Angler. Actually, I was working for the Bighorn Angler on the Bighorn River for a short period.
I know.
And I bet. And a guy came into the shop. He was staying there. It was kind of a more of a lodge. We had some rooms and stuff, and he'd stayed there for a few days. And he was telling me, oh, you should put together a group and bring your group down to this place in Belize called Turn of Flats that I'm a shareholder in. And I thought, wow, that sounds pretty cool. And then shortly after that conversation, I met my girlfriend.
Was that Jim Adams?
It's Jim, all connected. Right? It was, it's all connected. It was, and I feel really bad because I'm blanking out on his name, and I hope he doesn't listen to this because he was quite a good friend for a long time. He'd come fit. But anyway, I'll probably think of it later, but anyway, and then shortly after that, I met a woman who I thought was pretty cool. And when I met her, I said, you know, you're really cool. We can hang out, but someday I'm going to go move to Belize and I'm going to manage this lodge called Turn of Flats. And I'd never been there. And I'd, you know, and she's like, where's Belize? And I said, it's somewhere in Central America. I think it's by Mexico. And she's like, yeah, yeah. Okay. Whatever. And then 2 years later, Craig Hayes was sitting in with us in a restaurant in Bozeman interviewing us for the job. And, yeah. And then we went down there together and she'd never left the country and we actually had a little wedding ceremony, at the lodge. So all of the guides and the staff were right there in the main lodge. We got married the last day we were there before we left to go back to Montana. And then Craig ended up buying his townhouse in Montana so that we could live there. And my wife continued doing reservations for Turner Flats for a while before we moved to Vermont. So yeah, it's all connected. And Jim Adams, of course, was a guide for the Yellowstone Angler. And yeah, it's a small world.
Wow. Yeah, this is very funny. I was in a trip to Belize. This was 1998, maybe 1999. Mm-hmm. Invited by a guy. He used to be the CEO of Cutco. It's a company of knives. It doesn't matter.
Cutco?
Cutco. You know the company probably.
Yeah, I know Cutco, yeah.
Oh, yeah, well, of course. Well, this guy was, the name was Don Muldreth, and he used to live in Napa. Right?
I know the name.
Okay. So Don said, Paolo, we need good casters and good photographers, so you invited to Belize. I said, what? Yeah, you invited to Belize. Oh, okay. Well, of course, I paid my ticket, but everything was for free. So after that, I organized a trip to Yellowstone. This was August. September that year, I organized a trip to Yellowstone with some folks here in Chile. Do you get me? Connection is going mm-hmm. slow. Yeah, okay.
Yeah, no, we're good.
Okay. So I do the trip to Yellowstone, and I meet Jim Adams there. I was a longtime friend of Jim for many years before. And he goes like, Paolo, Jim Brungard, yeah, we're having a barbecue at Jimbo's place in between Bozeman and Livingston, right in the middle. He had a house. Mm-hmm. Okay. And big barbecue. Actually, I was doing the pisco sour, so at the end, almost everyone ended up drunk. Well, whatever. and Jim Adams goes like, Paolo, Jimbo told me that you just pulled out of Belize. I mean, you just had a trip to Belize. I said, yes. Did you like it? Oh, man, of course. So where were you? I was on a ship. Oh, really? What did you do? Well, we set sail from Belize City down to Plasencia, and we were just chasing permit. Actually, we caught permit. Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
He said, well, would you like to go again? And we're like, of course. Why? And he goes, I'm inviting you. I say, yeah, come on, go. I mean, don't kid me. Come on. He said, no, I'm inviting you. You're kidding me. No, go with your girlfriend. I don't have any. Well, invite our friend then. And go like, where? He says, to Turner Flats. Why? Well, we're building a fam trip. And I said, why are you building a fam trip to Turner Flats? Because I bought some shares of the property. I go like, mm-hmm. what? Yeah, that was almost year, I think it was 2000, 2001, 2002, more or less.
That's right about the time I showed up on the scene in Bozeman. Now I remember that. So very, and Livingston. So
what
Pablo, I think world. You and I, it's a small world. And if anybody's still listening to this, they realize that we just went off the reservation and maybe if they're listening still, it's because they know some of these names as well. And I appreciate the opportunity to have the conversation with you. I'm curious, are there any questions? Cause we could probably speak for another 4 hours. Are there any questions that I should have asked, forgot to ask, or anything you want to make sure our listeners hear before we wrap up?
Well, I don't know which are your listeners going to be. If they're into fly fishing, yeah, probably which are the best spots in Chile? What is the best time of the year?
Let's do this because I know that you know all the answers to that. I'm going to have your link in the show notes to your business website. And obviously they've got your name. I know they can find you through social media. If somebody's looking to try and set something up, is it okay if they reach out to you directly to have that conversation?
Oh yeah, of course. Well, actually that's what I do. That's my business.
I figured you'd say yes. It was okay.
We do Chile and Argentina, but we book a lot of Peru and Ecuador as well. We don't do that much Brazil. And yes, we do a lot of bookings in Europe. So you're going to laugh about this. I have clients from the U.S., Canada, and Europe that book through me here in Chile to do something in Europe. And you're going to go like, you're crazy. Well, no, I know France a lot, Spain as well, and Italy. Not that much the south, but all of the north. Yes, I can do some pretty amazing things. Even some parts in Africa. Yes.
Cool. So what I just heard you say was anybody that's listening to this that feels some sort of connection with you, feel like you're the type of person that would get them or would be able to help them, then they should just reach out to you and connect and see what happens. Is that an accurate way to put it?
Yeah, cool. Sure.
And of course, I'm going to recommend it because I know the great work that you've done in the past and great conversation and small world. And thank you so much for coming onto the show today. I appreciate you, Pablo.
My pleasure. Thank you for inviting me.
It was a lot of fun. We'll talk to you soon.
Ciao.
I trust you enjoyed listening to the conversation as much as I enjoyed recording it. If you're enjoying the Big World Made Small podcast, please take a moment to tell the algorithm by subscribing and posting a review so that others can benefit as well. I also invite you to take a quick trip over to bigworldmadesmall.com and join our private adventure travel community to receive new episode notifications, special access to our guest experts, and perhaps even some exclusive partner offers that we haven't discussed on the podcast. I'll publish another episode soon. Until then, keep exploring. It's the best way to make a big world feel just a bit smaller.